Okay, everybody, so let's get started for today. What we're going to do is basically talk about two of the films for the class, Talk to Her and The Death of Mr. Lazarescu. I want to start with Talk to Her, and what I want to start with is having us look at a couple of scenes and sort of talk a bit about what's happening in these scenes, what are the stakes that we see. To that end, if you could pull out the article or pull it up on your computer for, that's called Talk to Whom, Redefining Autonomy and Talk to Her. I'd like to have that out as we talk about it. Let's see, no pun intended, yeah. Menu. And what we're going to be doing today is talking about a couple of scenes in Talk to Her, then I'm going to have us look at the articles for today, so the one on Talk to Her, and then a little bit on the one by Cindy Patton. And then what I'm going to have us do is break into two groups, and I'm going to have each group sort of take a scene from one of the two films. One group is going to take the scene from Talk to Her, and one is going to take a scene from Death of Mr. Lazarescu. And I want us to come back together and look at the scenes and have each group share with us what, in close reading its scene, what it has to say about the bioethical dilemmas that are raised in these films. In other words, this class semester long is obviously couched in clinical ethics. It's in our medical ethics department. And yet we've been thinking about cinema's purpose, its historical power, and its literary meaning in ways beyond just the ethical parameters. But today I'd like us to actually look at these films, at least when you break into groups, and think about what do they have to say about the ethical situations with which they dramatize, more specifically. And to that end, how do the films themselves provide a unique kind of contribution to that sort of discourse? But let's start with Talk to Her. And I'll pick the monitor to come up. Let's see. Is the light on the monitor at the top? Can you see?
Yes.
The green.
Yeah, the power's on.
Okay. Okay, ta-da! There we go. Okay. So, pulling out your copy of the article, Talk to Whom, if you could... first couple of pages with me for a second. Obviously, this is a book that comes from about bioethics at the movies, which we talked a bit about last class, and in particular about the way in which films are or aren't sort of valuable contributors to bioethical dilemmas. This article is actually kind of nice in the way that it considers a couple of specific bioethical concerns, even principles, if you will, and how they speak to what the drama is that's happening in this particular film. In other words, these sort of galvanizing sort of principles behind this article, and to some degree behind Almodovar's film, tend to be questions of autonomy, self-reliance, personal integrity, quality of life, and then the dilemmas that surround palliative care as well. To that end, the film itself, just in its setup, naturally lends itself to what would be sort of significant to a bioethical debate. But I also want to think about what the film does artistically that makes it worthy of that particular consideration. To that end, one of the things that's sort of significant about Talk to Her is not the subjects that it dramatizes and whether or not they're bioethical in nature, but the degree with which we do or don't empathize with figures in the film, which creates its own bioethical dilemma, I think. Now, Almodovar, how many of you have seen films by Almodovar before? He's kind of the most famous sort of Spanish director, certainly of the last, I'd say, 25 or 30 years. I've given the spiel on him before, but basically the thing to know about Almodovar is his films tend to be rather eccentric, rather colorful, very vibrant in the way that they enhance and embrace sort of Spanish culture, but also a bit countercultural itself in the way that they embrace characters who are criminals, prostitutes, transgender, and homosexual, insane, you name it. To that end, what he tries to provide is a really sort of like rogue cast of characters, but that also embody what are essential human and sometimes national principles from behind his particular kind of canon. To that end, Almodovar's films are at once wholly Spanish and beyond being Spanish. They are absolutely countercultural, and yet they seem to be right down the mainstream sometimes in the way that the relationships they deal with. And it's certainly been a movement in his career in the last 10 or 15 years. To that end, if you look at Almodovar films from the first, say, 15 or 20 years when he made films, starting in the early 1980s, pretty much through about the middle of the 1990s, those films tended to be embracing of the quirky side of the characters of that were being dramatized. So films like Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Kika, Matador, these are films that are absolutely about serious subjects, but they really embrace the way that they're sort of off the wall, sort of quality and character. And that is sort of what he made his name as, Almodovar did. But I would say probably around the late 90s, 90s, 2000, Motivar's films retained those same kinds of characters and some of that same flavor of eccentricity, as we'll see even in Talk to Her. But there was a move towards an even greater pathos in his work and an embrace on relationships that weren't just between lovers and criminals and families that are dysfunctional, but actually that at their core were questions about what does it mean to be a son? What does it mean to be a spouse? What does it mean to be a parent? These are the kinds of questions, and all their permutations, not even the traditional ones that we think of. So that Almodovar has retained the eccentricity of his particular vision, but in some way embraced some of the core central human relationships that any person would galvanize and gravitate towards. To that end, what we see then is literally, what we see is kind of artistically a maturation of his particular cinematic palette, but I think it's a literal maturation as well. The guy's gotten older, and as he's gotten older, he's begun to think, what matters? What counts? You know, family, friends, lovers, legacy, history, and these things become the center questions on top of, layered on top of the eccentric sort of like plots that have been a part and a feature of his films. One of his most famous films of the last 10 years or so was All About My Mother, which is a great film he made. This film is probably also one of the most renowned ones he's made in the last decade or so, Talk to Her. Its premise basically is the relationship of two men, each to a different woman. And each of those women are either in a coma or a persistent vegetative state. These are women who are somehow disabled or unresponsive in the hospital. And we have Benito and we have Marco, which is to say we have one person who is a nurse looking after a patient that he has grown quite affectionate of, Alicia, and then we have Marco who is visiting his girlfriend, Lydia, who is a famous female matador. What we have then in this film is clearly, like I said, a bioethical sort of plot line cater-made, you know, tailor-made, which is to say that like two people dealing in sort of like palliative care with individuals who are incapacitated, and what does it mean to respect their autonomy, their humanity, their quality of life, what kind of decisions do we make? It's just chock-a-block ready for us. So the person who wrote that stupid introduction to bioethics of the movies would think, the plot in this film is great for teaching bioethics, and it is. But let me tell you, this film is a great example of how film does more than just provide a pedagogical assistance to us. Because as we watch the film, who do we choose to sympathize with? Who do we choose to want to identify with? How much do we render human or not these women who are comatose? How do we feel comfortable or not with the fact that these women seem to have vitality only through the men who are agents in their lives in the hospital, or only through flashback and through most of the film, which is to say, is there a way in which, as cinema goers, we are not granting autonomy to these two particular fictional characters? To that end, Talk to Her is not just a film that provides bioethical drama. Watching it is to be put oneself in a bioethical quandary in the same sort of way. We are either complicit or not in how we choose to render autonomous or not the two women that are at the core of this particular film. What I'd like to do then is to sort of look at a couple of scenes, and like I said, then we're going to break into groups and sort of look at two scenes from two different movies and think about how they create quandaries of their own in doing the bioethical sort of movie-going experience. And looking at the article for Talk to Whom, if you could turn to page 320 in the article. So there's a paragraph in here on page 320 in this article. It starts with the idea that medicine, would somebody care to read that paragraph out loud for us? It's in some ways one of the theses of this particular article. Page 320.
The idea that medicine and cure cannot be effective without a broader understanding and knowledge of particular selves argued for under the relational feminist view is successfully represented as successful in the story of Benigno and Alicia. Though Benigno's acts may represent an extreme case of it. Unlike most films in the medieval movie genre, the story valorizes the contributions of those for whom care is a central concern. Long-term care nurses rather than, say, emergency medicine physicians or high-powered surgeons.
Thanks. So let's take a look at that last sentence again. Unlike most films in the medical movie genre, the story valorizes the contributions of those for whom care is a central concern. Care meaning here long-term care, caregivers, long-term care nurses, rather than, say, emergency medicine physicians or high-powered surgeons. Let's stop there for a second. Why do we think that, according to this article, and I think it's fairly true, emergency medicine physicians physicians and high-powered surgeons often are the valorized figures in medical films or television. I mean, and think about the TV shows we watch, too, about medicine. We sure as hell see a lot more about ER docs and surgeons than we do about other kinds of long-term caregivers. Yeah.
Because their action can be condensed into a particular snapshot.
So it lends itself to brevity. Brevity of either the TV show or the movie length or what have you. So the interaction, beginning, middle, and end, if it's played out in real time, it could be realistic that it could be in a film. Absolutely. So the time frame. What's another reason? Yeah.
Well, the actions that they're taking seem to be critical in terms of the life or death.
Yeah. If there is at the core of almost all medical narratives, and certainly all contagion films, the tension that life and death is but a tenuous sort of space to be in, these kinds of clinicians are balancing that exact thing, you know, the difference in how one cuts with the lancet, or the difference between whether or not one has assistance in performing CPR or doing emergency surgery shows just how close that line is. Caregiving long-term has the possibility also that life can end in a moment, but it also reminds us too that sometimes the distance between almost dying and dying is a long one at the same time, and that doesn't lend itself as well to cinema, or it's more difficult to do. So what's another reason? So we have the time constraint, we have the life and death sort of tenuous connection. Yeah.
I would say it also has to do with the transition from like private citizen to patient, is like the arrival in the hospital. You're not seeing somebody who is like, you know, it's easier to identify with the patients or to have the stories start there. It seems more like the beginning of it.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example. Which is to say that the ER doc and the ER narrative quite often has that because of the fact that it provides a good, and thus the story begins. To focus on caregiving or long-term caregiving is to almost feel as though one is coming very late into the story, so to speak, if one is in a palliative care or long-term care. So emergency medicine can certainly lend itself that way. I'll tell you another thing, too. The emergency medicine and the surgical medicine, as these two focus on, also deal with very specific spaces in the clinic and the hospital, too. So I think it has to do not just with profession, but also location, which is to say, where is this scene taking place? If it's being housed in an ER, or it's being housed in the privileged space that is the surgical ward, we have a very specific sort of structure that lends itself. Whereas caregiving, long-term caregiving, can happen at almost any place, and probably does over an extended number of places. So it becomes a feeling of unmanageability for the person who's trying to write this particular kind of narrative. Another reason, and this is probably the biggest one also too, is that at the level of what's being talked about here is not what kind of doctor narratives we see, but what are the ones that tend to valorize the most. And they tend to be surgical and emergency medical narratives, in large part because at the level of valorizing those professions, those two professions lend themselves more easily towards what seems heroic interactions or interventions with patients. You know, going in and performing CPR, doing the emergency surgery, doing a tracheotomy on the fly or what have you. Those sorts of like interventions seem to be the equivalent of what we think of as the heroic sort of clinician, if you will. So to that end, we tend to focus a lot. Whereas, to be honest with you, seeing the person that performs, you know, changing a feeding tube or turning somebody or giving meds 4 times a day every 6 hours, that doesn't always seem to lend itself to that heroic gesture that would render valor on the screen, television or cinema, and therefore it's underrepresented. Now, Talk to Her is prioritizing those kinds of representations. Yeah.
I also think it changes the focus of the plot line. If it's like an immediate emergent sort of setting, you care more about the patient's story, whereas in this movie, because the patients are, you know, don't interact, it becomes obviously more about the caretakers. And
this is the hard part, too, about these kinds of long-term caregiving things. So it's not just a difficult representation that we see just in representations of doctors. But if one focuses on what's called disability studies, if anybody has heard this, which is to say the study and the narratives that focus on those with chronic conditions, disabled conditions, long-term physical or mental or social sort of like conditions, disability studies very much wants to take up the call. That was the call of medical studies and history of medicine studies, which is to say, let's start looking at the patients more closely and not so much as at the clinical team. Those of you who study history of medicine with me or in general should know that the history of medicine, by and large, when it was first sort of created in the late 19th century as a discipline, through about the mid-20th century, was almost entirely a profession and a discipline that focused on great men of science, great practitioners of medicine, and great institutions or discoveries related towards science. To that end, it was very top-down. It focused on those who were privileged at the expense of not putting front and center people who were dealing with conditions or for laypersons who were worried about becoming sick with a condition? Or what was it socially like to understand a particular health situation or circumstance or intervention? Disability studies wants to take the figure of the disabled person, physical, mental, or otherwise, and to say, let's put that person front and center, but more importantly, let's also focus on the ability of the person that we label as disabled. To that end, what does the humanity of their life look like? How do the difficulties of it to be mentally or physically disabled actually reversed or are supported by a kind of study that puts primacy on their identity? To that end, there tends to be a real reluctance within disability studies and history and cultural and film studies to also want to focus on caregivers and caretakers. Large part being, then, are we taking our gaze away then from, our attention away from the person who's disabled if we focus on the caregiver or the caretaker? And that's another reason that cinematic narratives and such tend also to steer away from the narrative, as you said, because they tend to have us want to look at away sometimes from the patient, or to have us face that troubling question of, if we want to give the patient an utmost sort of like attention, what is it to turn our attention towards a nurse or a lover or a spouse or a father who comes to visit or an ex-boyfriend? And all of these figures sort of come in. We're so concerned with the cast of characters that comes to visit that it's troubling. And that's part of the reason I think the flashbacks are there. Without the flashbacks in this film, think how much more we would feel like we are objectifying the figure, the character, the body that's on the screen of these two women, so to speak. So it's another reason sort of we have this sort of like troubling relationship with focusing on caregiving and caretaking long term. A lot of reasons. So let's take a look at one of these scenes. This is a scene where we see some of the care for Alicia by Bonino sort of happening. And in watching this scene right now, I want us to pay attention to, it's about 4 minutes long, I want us to pay attention to how the framing is done, the interaction that's happening here between Bonino and Alicia, and in particular how the scene transitions from him talking to her, as the title suggests, having a connection, and we will find he later feels that he's in love and has an intimate relationship with her, but it moves towards them bathing and sort of like taking care of and washing her. And I want us to see how we see that moment, this interaction, as being one that's reverential or uncomfortable. Do we see it as one that objectifies the woman or one that actually shows tenderness towards her? And in particular with the amount of nudity that's in the scene, and the frankness with which she's washed in all places, do we find that this scene sexualizes the patient? And is that an uncomfortable thing, or is that a beautiful thing in this film, or both?
Y con los ojos cerrados, ¿cómo lo sonambulas? ¿Te da un miedo que las pobres se choquen con todo? Pero de repente aparece un hombre con la cara tristísima, la cara más triste que he visto yo en mi vida, y les va quitando manotazo limpio las sillas y las mesas para que no se tropiecen. No te puedes imaginar cómo era de emocionante. A mi lado había un hombre de más de 40 años, guapo, que lloró varias veces de emoción. La verdad que no era para menos, ¿eh? Qué bonito. Te traigo una sorpresa. Fui a los camerinos y le pedí a Pinabas un autógrafo para ti. Tuve que comprar la foto, ¿eh? Mira. Está en inglés. Pero dice algo así como que a ver si superas todos tus obstáculos y te pones a bailar. Le ha venido el periodo.
Pues se le ha adelantado.
Sí.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go back and look at some of this scene. Let's start with the first part where Benigno is speaking to her and he shows her the picture that he got autographed for her. And let's start to look at sort of how it's framed, how it's set up, whose face we see and who we don't, so to speak. And then how would you describe the relationship? So let's just watch this.
Pero de repente scene. Aparece un hombre. Con la cara tristísima.
And I'm just going to stop periodically.
La cara más triste que he visto yo en mi vida. Y les va quitando manotazo limpio las sillas y las mesas para que no se tropiecen. No te puedes imaginar cómo era de emocionante.
Okay, so this scene opens with him providing, it's basically a scene of, like, they're having girl talk, basically, kind of what's happening there, right? And significantly, he's doing her nails, I think is what he's doing there. Probably pushing the cuticles down, but it gives the illusion of what's happening here seems like it's in a clinical kind of caregiving, which is what it is. But it looks very reminiscent of what would happen when one person pampers another, if you will. If you notice, the scene also starts with the camera cut off right here below Benigno's neck, so to speak. It's a focus on the hands that are interacting, yeah. And therefore it sort of, in its close-up, almost takes us away from the clinical environment that we're in. Now what I love here in this moment here, though, is the pan that happens. The camera pulls to the right, and as it does, it follows down her arm, which at the end of it, her hand is being manicured, what have you, and it takes us to this shot. Now what do you think of this shot here?
She could be in a spa.
Yeah.
Totally. She looks like she's in the spa, doesn't she? I mean, we know that that's probably her normal look for also being in the ward here at the hospital. But coupled with that image of the girl talk, coupled with the manicure that's sort of happening there, the work on her nails or cuticles, this gives the illusion that what's happening here is a kind of really intimate and not necessarily clinical or sort of sterile, sort of like interaction that's happening. What does that choice in staging and in framing and in costuming right here change in a way that we feel comfortable or not with the relationship between these two? Describe how it feels in this moment watching Benigno with his patient.
Well, it feels loving.
Yeah.
And it sets the stage for being able to sympathize with him later when he acts in untoward ways that if had presented previously would have sent us in a very different direction.
Good. Yeah.
It doesn't feel totally comfortable to me because it feels already slightly sexual to me. I mean, just that. I mean, look at the look on her face, which is the look you can get in a spa when, you know, like you're totally
right.
Relaxed and blah, blah. But it's moving a little bit out of the context of caretaker and into something else.
And it's good that your phrasing is, it's moving a little too, and I'm a little uncomfortable, mm-hmm. Which is to say, I think that's what it's doing. It's not that the scene takes us entirely towards, like, and we're totally at ease now with the relationship between these two. But as you're a little bit uncomfortable, that also means you're a little bit comfortable also, too, at the mm-hmm. same time. Because what you're seeing here is something that's straddling, rather than wholly being in this, because there's going to be scenes later that are totally... we feel uncomfortable. But I think there's some groundwork, as you said, that's being laid here for making us more comfortable. Yeah.
I think if you had found out he was the nurse before this scene, you might have been like, what is he doing? Like, it's not a clinical, but if you start out with this scene, it kind of comes, as you were telling Shelley, like, you do seem a little bit more comfortable with this relationship, seeing this scene first and then being like, oh, he's her caretaker, as opposed to, he's her caretaker, oh my God, why is he treating her like... you know, a manicurist.
Yeah, yeah, and which is to say that there's something dutiful at the level of what his duty is as nurse caregiver sort of in the scene, but there also seems to be something loving that's also happening here too. Now, whether that loving is weird or whether it's flattering is the part that we can't quite figure out yet in this particular film. And in fact, I think the whole movie is asking us to say there's a loving that's happening in this caregiving, and it's straddling between making me comfortable and making me uncomfortable. And that's what the movie is about trying to sort out, both for that the characters in the movie and also for us as well in watching it. Thus, the ethical dilemma he's having and the relationship he's having with her is the same one we're having with the characters themselves. That's why this film is more than just a teaching tool on bioethics. As we choose to empathize or not with her or with him, that's the struggle that they're having themselves, and what's the appropriateness of this particular relationship. Let's see where this scene goes next. After this sort of pseudo-manicure, we get the next portion.
A mi lado había un hombre de más de 40 años, guapo, que lloró varias veces, de emoción. La verdad que no era para menos, ¿eh? Qué bonito. Te traigo una sorpresa. Fui a los camerinos y le pedí a Pina Wolf un autógrafo para ti. Tuve que comprar la foto, ¿eh? Mira. está en inglés. Pero dice algo así como que a ver si superas todos tus obstáculos y te pones a bailar.
Okay. Now, the first episode we had with them was the manicure that's sort of happening, and now we turn to this one where he's gotten the autographed picture for her. How do you feel about this little moment, him showing the picture to her? Just in its narrative content. Do you find that sweet? Do you find that creepy? Do you find it... And I'm asking very, very directly at the level of what is your sort of reader response to this, because I think this is part of what the film is trying to do to us ethically. How do we feel watching these kinds of scenes? Anybody? Shelley?
I didn't feel bad with the picture and him showing to her. That's what I would have done with a little kid that might not be verbal yet. Like, I would do that kind of thing. I'm less comfortable with the picture of her there, like that you've stopped the frame on, because she's too perfect there. Like, I mean, like, there's no errant eyebrow hairs or anything. Like, I mean, she's just so taken care of beyond what you would take care of.
Well,
so the visual, I didn't mind the thing. And I find it going into his pathology of being able to love where there's no threatening. Like, the pathology of there's no threat to this relationship because she can't say anything.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we could try to psych out his motives about why he finds her so wonderful in terms of it plays into his caregiving things. She can't talk back, you know, that sort of thing or whatever, you know. But we do know that, if nothing else, the man has the capacity to be incredibly dutiful. And here is a patient that not only provides the opportunity for him to do it, but maybe in the way that which she seems so lovely as a patient and the way that she looks, that is partly what troubles us. Shelley, you said that she looks like there's not an errant eyebrow hair or whatever thing. That's totally true. One of the scenes I love, the shots I love, is just before this when he goes to get the picture out of the closet. Do you remember what we see
and
in that scene? Oh my goodness! Oh my goodness! It's like a day spa, isn't it? Let's see.
She probably didn't have that in her own apartment when she was alone.
Right? Oh, here we go. Just prior. Let's take a look.
Guapo. Que lloró varias veces. De emoción. La verdad que no era para menos, ¿eh? Qué bonito. Uf. Te doy una sorpresa.
Yeah, I mean, it's just moisture after moisturizer after nail polish after, you know, facial cleanser after you name it, so to speak, you know. So, and we get the sense probably too that a lot of this is from on his part, sort of like stuff he's has there for her to take care of her. So the degree to which she's being groomed and pedicured to such a degree is flattering, and it's beautiful and it's lovely to look at, but like that shot, it's also a little bit discomforting at the same time. Anybody else, this little interaction with the photo, thoughts about how it made you feel? Chelsea?
From a medical standpoint, I've heard that patients in these, like, that talking to patients and engaging them and smells and music and all sorts of things like that do benefit. I don't know if they've actually done clinical studies, but I've heard that like, any kind of stimuli, like, and trying to engage them can work. So I was less sort of put off. But I kept thinking about how, at the end, part of why she looks the way she does was because of all this, and so you're sort of, I kept having to justify that in my head, like how...
So tell me how to make you feel,
as much as I was disturbed by this attraction that he had to her, there was sort of a sense of, well, part of the reason why she's doing so well now and looks so good was because someone did take the time. So that valorization of the long-term care, it's like no one ever considered that he's this pervert, lock him up. Like, but she, maybe one of the reasons why she came out of this state was because he engaged her every single day and took her out in the sunshine and talked to her and showed her pictures and bought her
I'll things. Tell you something about those studies that say you should, you know, that's the title of this movie, you
right
know, people who are disabled or people who are comatose or whatever, you should talk to them, interact with them, speak to them, music, stimulate them, all that sort of stuff, that there is actual statistical evidence in the same way that, like, you know, we all had somebody in fourth grade in their science project who did the experiment experiment about like talking to your plants and playing Mozart music for them and they grew better, right? Seriously, I'm not equating plants with people who are in a vegetative state, but what I'm saying is the results are the same in terms of how beneficial it is to have humane interaction with that which you otherwise might have paused not to because you're worried that it's futile. It almost always leads to improved care. Now, on the one hand, the logic behind that is that there is something therapeutic and that kind of music playing, talking, what have you, that they are responding to in a person who's in a vegetative state. But the actual part of the evidence that's most convincing is the fact that when one does greater attention towards playing music, towards talking to patients, you're also that much more dutiful and attentive to the things you're supposed to be doing in caregiving anyway. So the fourth grade science project about playing Mozart for the music for the plants, it's not the Mozart music that's probably doing the most thing. It's that you're probably being more attentive about the light it's getting, the watering, the fact that it needs to be looked after, all the other things. The Mozart is just the vehicle that's taking you there towards doing the caregiving better. So too is often the case, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be not talk to people who are disabled or are in a persistent vegetative state or a coma because of the fact that we shouldn't try to speak to them. Of course we should, but we can't ignore the fact that with that human interaction, with the person who's in a disabled state, what comes with it is a whole host of other actual caregiving practical things that are improved. And this scene is kind of tapping into that. He has got an autographed picture for her, he plucks her eyebrows, he does her nails, but by God, I bet the woman doesn't have a bed sore on her anywhere. Yeah. I bet you $100. And I think that has a lot to do with those extra things he's doing for her. So as much as we can be uncomfortable by the fact that he's going up to her with an autographed picture and hanging it over her face and her eyes are as closed as can be, you know, we also know she looks great and is probably in great healthy condition because of these extra things he's giving to her. And therefore, the film asks us, how far do we want to take that? His love, his devotion, his intimacy, his sexual interaction with her, how much are we willing to sacrifice in terms of the extra things he can shower on her for the benefit of what her actual health is? And that is the result of the film. She does come out at the end of her coma, so to speak, and we're left to think, I bet in no small part it has to do with the attention he brought on her, not least of which because we know the sexual interaction that happens that makes her pregnant and gives birth to a child, we're told is the thing that begins to spark her coming out of her coma, which is to say we have gone so far in allowing him to shower attention and expand his dutifulness to her that now it's become sexual. And we're going to look at that scene in a second. And even that scene is not totally vilified in this film. That not only does it render us more comfortable with him taking care of her, but it actually has a therapeutic outcome that's actually beneficial for her too. And how bad does that make us as moviegoers, as cinema watchers in that particular sort of narrative or structure? Any questions or comments?
I wanted to ask a question to you. I did think it was interesting, though, from uncomfortable versus comfortable, is they started with the close-up on her breasts.
We're going to get to that scene in a second. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anybody else about this particular scene, though? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, this one, when he's in the movie theater and he's kind of checking out this guy who's sitting next to him, so I think it calls into question his sexuality, which can make us less inclined to take affection as being kind of transgression, like a transgression.
Yeah.
Particularly when he's describing him as beautiful to her, he's a beautiful man, he was, you know, being guapo, whatever he's, you know?
Yeah.
So I think the fact that we like don't yet know he's a nurse, the fact that we don't yet know the context of the relationship, and the fact that we don't know his sexuality makes us a little more permissive in how we...
Totally. That's why I call it the girl talk scene, because it does seem like the interaction like a gay man would have with his girlfriend. He's doing her nails, she's got her head back, I got the autographed picture for you, you know, that sort of thing. Trust me, I know that interaction. And like, it seems to me that that's part of the thing that puts us at ease here in this moment. But that's also part of the thing that gives us, I think, another bioethical sort of quandary, and I have it, in particular watching this as a queer individual, which is to say, we see this in Benigno's interactions with Marco as well, too. Not just in the movie theater, but later as well, which is to say that like, do they have a kind of attraction, or does at least Benigno have an attraction to him? To that end, what then of his infatuation with this woman? What then of the fact that he wants to consummate that relationship with Alicia? Am I rendered more comfortable with his interaction with her because of the fact that I think he could be potentially gay? Or am I also then discomforted by the fact that he's using this woman as a kind of female body with which to justify and affirm his heterosexuality, which might not actually be the case. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, there's a kind of sexual bioethical sort of like tension that this film is providing for us.
And does it pathologize it because clearly he has issues with his mother and caretaker, you know?
Yeah.
Being her caretaker, and then is this Alicia becoming a surrogate for his mother, and when his sexuality is in question, what does that say about?
Which is really one of the dilemmas about this relationship between Alicia and Benigno, which is to say, at its surface, as this article tries to describe us, it seems like it's a movie that's about what is being done in the care for this woman who is in a comatose state. But really, it's oft in many ways about the way in which the pathology is not hers that we're concerned with, but his. And how is her body being used as an agent in the execution or treating of his own pathology? So it actually flips who we think. We think it is caregiver and patient, and she is the patient, of course, because she's in a coma, and he is the caregiver, of course, because that's what his paycheck says, and he works for the hospital. But in many ways, when his pathology is put front and center, it's the other way around. She is caring for him. And he is the person that we are problematized by bioethically in terms of, is he being healed in a way that troubles us in this particular film? Let's see the rest of this film and this scene and see again the details and what Chelsea was starting to have us look at. How exactly is it cropped here, this kind of washing scene that happens?
Okay, a ver si superas todos tus obstáculos y te pones a bailar.
The nurse is wearing gloves and he's not, right?
Mm-hmm. So we have two sets of hands, which in itself feels a little bit, you know, strange, of course, right? We have a focus on her breasts. Chelsea, what did that make you think?
Well, only because they then pan down to her feet and there's a close-up of her feet. Why didn't it start with the feet and go up?
Why did it start with her face and go down?
Yeah. I mean, I just kept...
Well, let's just start with why did it focus on her breasts?
To introduce the question of comfort, discomfort?
I think so. I think it puts front and center, you know, sort of like the question about whether or not we are objectifying or in some way infringing on the dignity of this patient, if you will. And we focus on her face and lingered on it on that moment that Shelley wanted us to look at. But here we're sort of just going even more objectifying and looking at her breasts. I find it interesting because the scene starts and we just see her breasts and we see the hands washing her, you know, one with gloves on or what have you. And at first we can't see any sign of what is the impairment in this patient. Then for a moment, one of the hands moves and we see a small sort of gauze bandage right here, you know? And then the camera moves up just ever so slightly, because it starts actually at about here, the top of the frame is, right? And then after about 10 seconds, it starts to move up. And it only moves up so far, not that it shows us her chin or her face or her eyes or anything, but just her trach is all we get to see in that particular moment. So to that end, what is initially a sexual sort of like scene, you know, breasts front and center in a picture, is now added with a trach into the picture. And it's the juxtaposition, I think, of those two things that in some ways encapsulates what this entire woman's objectification, the entire film is about. She is at once a medical object and she's a sexual object. She is a trach and a pair of tits. You know, that's what we got up there on the screen. And we're left troubled by that particular image. Yeah, totally.
Oh, and then it like pans down and then they're like, oh, she got her periods. I just thought that was all like squirt.
We'll get there in a second, Chelsea.
I'm going. I just was like, I didn't know how to feel. I kept thinking like, is it okay? Is it not? Did they really like her? And then they just kind of squirted her.
Yeah, well, let's stay on this scene though. The thing that's troubling is the fact that, and how one understands whether or not one feels comfortable or not is to sort of like hold on this particular moment and see what it has to say to us. So we have here then the hands, we have the naked chest, we have the trach that's showing. But what we also have too here then is what's missing. I told you that framing is important, not just for what's in the shot, but for what's outside, what's left out of the frame. So we don't have her face here. Mm-hmm. How would it be different if we did have her face in this shot?
She wouldn't be so objectified. You'd actually see a person instead of a body.
I don't know. Would she be or wouldn't she? It's hard to tell. Part of us thinks that she'd be less objectified because we tend to think that there would be something more human because you actually get to see the face of the person, and this has an almost decapitation sort of quality to it. But what if we saw her face? And we've seen her face in the last scene, just prior. Imagine cutting out that last shot and placing it right on top of this one, right above it.
And then, like, touching her without her...
With her eyes closed, blank, you know, expression, would that feel like even more of a manhandling or not? And we're conjecturing here, yeah.
I think it emphasizes the focus on the work that's being done rather than...
Yeah, which is to say that this is one of the hallmarks of that kind of professionalism in medicine and the clinical gaze itself. You know, it's when we talked about Foucault, that part of the way to do better medicine in the 19th century moving into the 20th century, histology was to think about how one narrows one focus to the site of attention that needs to happen. Now, one of the byproducts of that, according to Foucault and medical theory, is the fact that it tends to render less holistic, less whole the individual patient, and therefore sometimes less humane. You are not seeing me as a whole person, you are just seeing me as a wound or a cyst or a lesion or what have you. But medicine feels that one is more professional when one focuses. One is more strategic and one is more pointed. Yes, I may ignore sometimes Brenda or whoever the face and person that this person is, but by God, I know that lesion inside and out, and I'm going to take care of it well. What is happening in this scene by the exclusion of the head here is some of that narrowing of the clinical gaze. And what the film is providing for us is no absolute resolution about whether that is or isn't more comfortable in this moment. But what it shows is that the strategy clinically of what's happening is also mirrored in some way with the strategy cinematically. What's happening here? Is this a moment where I choose to render the holism of the person and their humanity? Or is it one way in which I choose to narrow the focus? And here it's been chosen to narrow in a way that's troubling, but also in a way that we feel might be efficacious. Yeah.
Also, they're not talking to her in this scene. That they talk to each other about her.
Yeah.
Whereas in the last scene, when you see her face, he's talking to her. It looks like there's more of a conversation going.
So yeah.
It's going back to the clinical thing. It's you're seeing her more as a body in the scene instead of a person.
And that's a good way to think about too what the title is saying, and then also what the strategy might be for when is it warranted to see her face and to render her as a complete sort of individual character in this particular. So in this scene, it would be almost disingenuous and maybe cruel to represent the entirety of the woman's anatomy and body and face, and yet within the drama and narrative that's being played out, she's not being treated that way. So as in the scene, she is being treated as a body that needs to be cleansed and cared for, so too the cinema sort of follows suit, follows claim, if you will. And I think there might be a kind of, I haven't gone through every scene in this film, but there might be a parallel with which whatever is clinically the strategy for what's happening in a particular moment, there might be a cinematic parallel, and that might be an interesting sort of way to think about it. Let's keep seeing where the rest of this goes, because I'm interested also in the way that there's a kind of like artistry as well, and the way that we have absolute symmetry in the representation of this particular moment. So of course we have the head cut off I talked about, and we don't see the faces of the nurses that are carrying her, but the breasts are both front and center and absolutely centered in the frame as well. And that particular symmetry here adds another kind of clinical dimension to it, but also a kind of unwavering sort of like attention to what we're seeing here. So we cut to the feet. And bear in mind that we're still above, bird's eye view. You know, the same shot that we saw earlier with the face of her, that Shelley pointed out to us, is pretty much the same perspective here. It's just that now we've gone from her head earlier, after we saw the picture, down to the breasts, and now we're down at the feet, but still above. And this is the point where it changes. Okay? So now where are we looking from?
From her point of view.
Yeah. They've got her, and not only from her point of view, if you noticed how the camera moves. So the camera has just been steady overhead two or three shots in a row now. Now there's going to be some camera movement. And up. Which gives the illusion of what? Yeah,
what?
Yeah. She's moving, or she's present, or she's somehow conscious of the observation. It's the same movement, I think, what one would see, ladies, anyone, if you had to go in for a gynecological exam, lay down and put your head back, and then if they want to talk to you, you're sort of up your head comes, so to speak, you know, after you've been examined, you know? Which is to say that there's a way in which the camera, if she is lifeless within the plot of this film, the camera is giving just an echo, just a hint towards the fact that there is an observation that might be from her perspectives. It's us that's watching it. So I want to talk about how bioethically problematic it is to watch a movie in a significant way. This camera movement right here is putting us in that very perspective. So now we see them talking about her having her period. We mentioned that we don't get to see her face, but we're actually watching the entire interaction. Look, the camera's still moving.
No, I'm not comfortable.
Okay. So that scene and how it ends, how quickly it's done and how it ends, did you find it to be an example of efficacious clinical sort of care in that particular moment, or a kind of inhumane manhandling?
certainly wasn't pampering. It certainly wasn't spa-like.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very brushed, very clinical, very much like dealing with like an unpleasant matter as opposed to like giving a manicure.
Mm-hmm.
Or washing breasts.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And we were, and unlike the washing of breasts,
you didn't have like gloves on either.
And unlike the washing of
you guys, really though, I mean, it's like there's blood, and it's like, you know, it's just this like total sort of stark move, especially like the camera angles and everything.
And of course, the other thing, of course, though, is that there is a degree of respectfulness and concealment in the way that the drapery is still over her legs. So unlike the washing of the breasts, which is front and center for all, come on in if there's somebody outside the hallway that's watching somebody get their tits washed, right? In this scene, there's actually some degree of decorum, if you will, to some degree. So it's uncomfortable, and it's hard to see the way, and it's sort of the camera angle panning and us feeling like we're her head sort of watching this happen. But we also know that there's something slightly respectful and that there's a little bit of covering that's happening there. I don't know about you, but the procedure itself at once leaves me uncomfortable the way that it's sort of done and squirt and wash and all that. But there's another part of me of like, well, they got in, got the job done, and got out as quick as they could.
That's
and that's
so freaking efficient. Like,
you know what I mean?
How could you not make a mess? And look at that. Look at that thing. It's like hospital.
But quarters. I mean, the efficiency of the procedure is also part of what's supposed to render it slightly more comfortable, which is to say the procedure itself might be uncomfortable, but its clarity is in some way something that provides for us some sense of assessment. Yeah.
The other thing in the beginning when you saw the breasts and you focused on the trach, the other thing that was clinical in it was the sound of the water. Like that, like, I know when I broke my leg, and God bless this woman who actually washed me, and I loved her because she did it, but that sound of the water also clinicalizes it as well. It took it away. So it wasn't just the trach. I've just, he focuses on the sound of it. There's a sound of the water.
Well, and all the sounds that are in that scene are actual environmental noises that are taking place. By contrast, we cut to this scene where we're back overhead now, and we see the entirety of the woman, right, in her body here. The linen that was hinted at before that was over her legs now is sort of like the purpose of this moment. But it's also when the sounds change, because the score comes in here. So let's watch this last portion. And I want you to watch it, and think of how the score is added, why it's added, why the totality of the woman's body is included, and yet the scene is basically, for all of the frankness that we saw in the last scene of the washing and the breasts and the legs and the feet, this scene is the whole of the woman, but playing with concealment and reveal, basically, and the way she's being draped and undraped, clothed, and the towel sort of coming off of her. Think about why it's done that way, and with the music added in. What is the feeling then we're supposed to have in watching this? So let's talk about that scene then. What did you make of the use of the music there? Anybody?
It's actually almost identical to two things. Mozart Requiem and Barber's Adagio is like the second one. It's like the same notes practically. It's like these melancholy, like, I just felt like I was watching Platoon all over again.
Yeah, that does remind us of that, yeah. So what's the emotion here? What's the feeling?
It feels like a funeral to me. There was like a funereal feeling to it, and they're putting the white thing over her.
The procedure that's happening here, the way that, when have we seen these images before? The sheet going over the head is the classic one of the person has just expired, right? And that's the sheet goes over. And of course it's a tease though in this film, because it's put over, and it's pulled off, and then the thing is put over her head, and then it's pulled under. I mean, even the scene where they put the gown or the dressing over her, with the sheet underneath, and they pull it, like, you know the old gag in movies and TV show where someone has a table that's set and the magician comes up and takes the tablecloth and goes and pulls it out and all the dishes and everything still stay. There's a little bit of that sort of in the pulling of the thing out from underneath of the gown. There's an almost reverential respect in this scene towards not wanting to objectify or sort of be indecent towards showing her body, which is in stark contrast to what we just saw just a couple of seconds prior to it. And yet the music is added, I think, to enhance that sense of the reverential. It feels funeralistic in some ways, right? But it also is supposed to be sort of tender, I think, in the moment as well. I mean, one of the things that always comes to mind for me, especially that very, very, very first moment where we see the drape being laid on top of her. Let's see. First shot. Here, right here. It strikes me, and maybe this is my Catholic upbringing, but very sort of Shroud of Turin-esque. You know what the Shroud of Turin is? Right? It's the drape that sort of Jesus was supposedly sort of buried in, and therefore when it was discovered, it's proven not to be an actual relic from that era, but it had some markings on it that looks like there was the body of Christ on it. But there seems to be in this white sheet that slowly comes down, a kind of imprint of the woman being left onto this, which says nothing more to me in my reference to it, not that she's like some Christ figure or something, but the reverence that the music is endowing in the scene. Iconographically, I feel like it's being reinforced by the way in which this particular sheet or scrim is being laid down on top of her. Now, in the dressing of her, I also find it interesting too. So the sheet comes down, very Mary Mother of God colors, by the way. And this dress, like, covering. Lovely. The collar, Which is to say, I think they're trying to dress her in clothing that... Now, did you notice there what happened, too? In that moment? Small thing.
Other half of the gown.
So we've from here, and now notice there, there's this, it's called like a fade overlay, which is to say, the purpose of that kind of overlay, if you've seen it before, is to suggest the passage of time. It's basically the equivalent of ellipses in a you know, dot, dot, dot in a film, which is to say, you know what's happened basically in the next 10 seconds here, which is to say, they do it all the time on cooking shows, right? If you've seen this, so to speak. Then what happened was we saw this scene in real time. The sheet comes down, the dress is pulled back, the dress is laid over, the sheet is pulled under, they start to do the first tie, they start the second tie, fade out, fade back in, and they're tying the last one. Which is to say, in that fade out and fade in, what is there is them tying the rest, these other ones in between. Why doesn't it want to linger and have us see the other ones getting tied?
Because this whole process has been so efficient and almost very beautiful, and that actual step is probably the least.
It's boring.
It's attractive, it's boring. And
we've seen it, we get the idea. And I think it's taken out because of the fact that we, as you said, it would take away from the efficiency. I love that point because I didn't think of that. It takes away from the efficiency of what this moment could be. But also, it prevents the fact that that tediousness of time, those things could take away from the artistry that's in this particular moment. That's a very small moment. And you know how much they probably cut out in doing it, El Modovar? 2 seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, tops, what have you. But that decision to do that, to have that overlay, is a very strategic one, artistic on his part. To want to show the efficiency and the reality of what's happening in this moment, but to manipulate it ever so slightly so it comes off even more lovely. Which is to say, with the Shroud of Turin-esque sort of look and what the score laid on top to tomb-like is doing, even that small little fade that's happening there in the middle is doing some of that kind of work as well. Yeah?
It also keeps her glamorous. A lot of caring for ill people or people who are comatose is very unglamorous. And
yeah.
Even though we have a scene prior that with the period and cleansing, it is a little less glamorous, and it's still done in a very modest way. Mm-hmm. If you had to flip her and lift her up, that would be very cumbersome.
Yeah.
And it would take away from the glamour that, that has been established for her throughout the entire, from her being a dancer throughout the rest of the film.
Yeah. Which is interesting because, to be honest with you, if you don't know this, caring for an invalid like this, particularly somebody who's in a coma or a persistent vegetative state, 75% of the care is turning. It's what you're doing. Wow. It really is. I mean, it is meds and it is feedings and it's changing diapers and it's taking care of periods and stuff like that, but it's being there to turn. Mm. Every couple of hours, every hour if need be or what have you, because bed sores are really the worst enemy for somebody that's bedridden, if you will. And to that end, it is tedious and it's not glamorous to look at, so to speak. And it does strike at what is probably the most tragic thing. This is a woman whose profession was movement. She was a dancer. And now she's rendered totally an invalid. And the movie, in moments like this, choosing not to show her being turned, so to speak, takes away some of the heartache that could come in watching a woman who made a career and an identity out of movement to have to be moved by others. It's her stasis, don't get me wrong. It's heartbreaking in this scene, too. This is a woman that wants to get up and dance. We know she's got the ability for it, and we see it in flashbacks, and yet we see no movement at all from her. So that contrast is what's supposed to be provided here. But this gown and the kind of tying that it provides on the side also prevents us from having to do the turning that could be a part of it.
Doesn't that also take away, like the reality of the situation, which is part of her agency, even as like a comatose individual.
Yeah.
Like the more we glamorize her, the more she's an object, the less she is,
yeah.
you know, existing mm-hmm. in the reality of the state that she's in, which is.
And absolutely. And my point about lingering on the score or even that little 2 seconds with the fade in and fade out is that in many moments this film is less concerned with the reality of what it is to care for a patient than what it is artistically or aesthetically or emotionally or ethically it wants to give across in its message. To that end, this film is not a perfect witness to what it's like to care for somebody who's in a coma or a persistent vegetative state. That's not what the film wants to do. That's not what the film's about. It gives us some glimmers of what that looks like, but it's far more interesting, far more sophisticated, and far more bioethically valuable when we see it as more than just an eyewitness on what it is to care for somebody. It's doing much more complicated things. I think that's what you're alluding to as well. Any last thoughts on this? I mean, just looking at this sort of image here, it does again look like what we might see at somebody being prepared or dressed for the funeral. The way that she looks, the way that she's been cleaned, the way that she's been dressed in her nicest sort of clothes. And of course, the one thing that we have here that clues us in, besides the plot, to know that she's not dead is that she still has the trach. And I mean, that would have been removed if she had expired. And so to that end, we know that this is somebody who is viable, who is still alive, and yet troublingly being treated as though in ways that remind us of how we pamper or prepare somebody for funeral after they have died. To that end, what's being hinted at is the reality, not the situation, not alone, but also what could come if she should pass away, or what could have been if she hadn't have had the condition that she has right now. It's not so much a film just of its moment, caring for somebody in the ward, but also thinking about what that reminds us of caring for that person outside of the ward, or out after the ward, or what it would be like to bury them as well. Any last thoughts here? Yes, Chelsea?
The one thing that I thought of actually with the overlay of the sheet and the gown was a massage, because there's a way to lift the sheet when you're in a massage, where they
yeah.
lift the sheet so that they don't see you, and that sort of brought me back to the hairband that she was wearing as the spa, and so I sort of thought
there's a thread running through it, and what's being reminded of you are various protocols for what constitutes propriety in a particular profession or moment or scene. And so in this scene, we're getting ones that seem clinically appropriate, ones that seem spa appropriate, ones that seem, you know, sauna appropriate. I don't know. And so to that end, what we're trying to figure out is what is the appropriate way with which to deal with this particular woman, her identity, her body, her sexuality, her health, if you will. Because that's the dilemma that the entire film is having with her as a character, and with a person such as this who is in a comatose sort of state. Our wanting to be comfortable with how to see her just as a character in the cast of people in this particular film is what's happening in the scenes for how it's being represented in her body, disclosed or not disclosed. Shelley?
I'm just dealing with that first question or comment you made about it always helps to talk to somebody or to play music or whatever, and I was thinking back to the discussion of Terri Schiavo and how the consultations were so easily saying that there's nothing there. Like, there's just nothing there. So, I mean, is there nothing there, or is there something there? Do you know what I mean?
In the case of Terri Schiavo, or in the case of this woman, or in the case
of... this woman purportedly is coma, but do they know if she's coma or PVS? Like, she's coma, and the other one's in PVS?
Mm-hmm.
So, Schiavo was persistent vegetative state?
Post-mortem, it was confirmed, yes. Mm-hmm. The debate was about before she passed away, was there any brain activity or not?
Right, so if she's in a persistent vegetative state, is there something that comes from talking to people?
Yeah, there is, but that something probably comes with the attentive added care that comes, not necessarily from the psychiatric or psychological sort of reaction that one's getting from the patient. Maybe. We're speculating here, of course, because we can't actually confirm it with the people themselves, you know, but we can know that people who are more dutiful in their interactions with the patients that they have, comatose, whatever class, in persistent vegetative state or not, are also the persons that are more likely to have better care as well. So the efficacy, is it psychological? I'm not sure. But does it lead to medical practical care? Absolutely it does.
But in a coma, there's speculation that in and of itself,
sure.
that thing is reaching through to
sure.
somebody?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, because if for no other reason, but we know that there are classes of a coma in which a person can have brain activity and appear to everybody else in the outside world as though to be non-responsive, and the person can actually be like, I heard you the whole time. You know, there have been actual, we know that that's an actual clinical fact. So yes, it is possible to do that. And that's another reason people are encouraged to talk to them, which is say it's feasible that he or she can hear us right now. It's possible. It's not without the, outside the realm of possibility here medically. And so that's another reason that kind of interaction is stressed. Having said that, and this film in the way that it represents certain scenes, interactive or not, vocally or not, and its title, which hovers over this entire film, asks us then, you know, what is the appropriate way with which to humanize, interact with, grant agency towards a person who's in a comatose state? And at the level of our cinema-going experience, we are then left to ask, how do we prioritize or not this individual as a character in this film? Do we recognize this person with all of the attributes that come with being a character in a film? Sympathy, frustration, anger, anguish, devotion, hope that it turns out a certain way or not for that person, protectiveness towards an individual, or wanting to, if we hate a character on screen, wanting to get justice for the things that they do wrong. How much do we feel invested in those particular characters in this film, the women themselves who are comatose, and their function as characters? As we choose not to, or do choose to see them as fully fleshed sort of characters, so too is the dilemma in life about whether or not we choose to see these individuals as fully fleshed sort of people. And what Almodovar is constantly doing, both visually and I think narratively as well in this film, is asking us to challenge how we see, and thus the ability to occasionally decapitate in the way that we frame, thus the ability to sometimes see whole or not the individual, to over-aestheticize or not aestheticize the individual. It's a dilemma about, is this a character or isn't it? And the flashbacks become troubling because of the fact that we are granted finally the ability to see these women as active, mobile, viable, completely functioning sort of individuals, and yet we know that it is as memory. It is as but a reflection through someone else of what this person was. And that then too means that these women again only seem to exist through interlocutor of some form, you know, and that becomes troubling for us as well. What I'd like to do now is sort of break the class into two groups to talk about those two scenes that I want us to think about. The first group, I'm just going to count off, 1, 2, 1, 2, if that's fine with people. So 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, you're leaving?
I'm up here, yeah.
1, 2. Okay, so that's perfect number. Group 1, I'd like you to take a look, and I'm going to give you the DVD to do this. It's scene number, well, it's about, I'll show you. It's the scene that comes about an hour into the film, and it's the scene where we learn about the rape. It's the rape scene, basically. We understand it, it's dramatized through the memories of a silent film that Benigno saw. And so the intercutting between, does everybody remember this scene where we
yes.
see this sort of the silent film in black and white, and then we sort of think about the fact of whether or not he wants to be intimate with her? I want a group to look at that scene and to see what it's doing visually, kind of not like we did here with this scene. What's happening in a very specific way in that scene, and why is it chosen to be represented that way? Particularly, it would be helpful for you, when you come back to the class, to share this scene and talk about it, to allude us to, on page 321, 320 and 321, there's a paragraph in this article that talks about sort of what is that scene trying to do. And in particular, the first paragraph on 321 ends with what is the function maybe of doing that kind of flashback between the two sort of scenes or what have you. So I'd like group one to take a look at that scene and to come back and talk to us about what's going on and be very specific like we are here, sort of going through point by point. Group number two, I would like to look at a scene from The Death of Mr. Lazarescu. Now, Death of Mr. Lazarescu is a Romanian film, and it's basically sort of based in part on The Death of Ivan Ilyich, which is to say it's focusing on sort of like the deathbed sort of moment of a person as being emblematic of what that entire life is like. And yet it's also a film that's kind of shot in real time. To give a little spiel on The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, when it first came out about 5 or 6 years ago, huge sort of international acclaim. It won one of the major prizes at the Cannes Film Festival. It won a lot of critics' prizes, both in the United States and internationally. It was not a very big commercial success, even by art house standards, either in the United States or internationally, but it was a sort of critical sort of favorite. And part of that is the fact that it's a very savvy and smart film, but it's also a very long and protracted sort of film, which is to say it is the death of Mr. Lazarescu. It is his last day on this earth, so to speak, that it's about. And it's basically about like him needing to get medical care on the day that he might potentially die, and the forestalling of that care actually coming. Which is to say, in some ways, although the film can be funny at times, it's also a troubling and not always enjoyable sort of film, too, to sort of see. So, to that end, the film's bioethical dilemma is what is uncomfortable in the narrative of what's happening in that film is also uncomfortable for us in sort of watching it, seeing a person being denied care, and our inability in witnessing that particular thing, turning it into our entertainment. how ethically fraught or not is that particular sort of feeling in that particular moment. To that end, I'd like the second group to take a look at a scene that's called Second Opinion, Same Diagnosis. It's probably the second or third hospital that Mr. Lazarescu visits. Now, what I want you to do is basically the film, if this scene, and talk to her, wants to spare us 9 seconds of having to see the second and the third and the fourth string being tied here because they figure it's going to linger too long, This is the death of Mr. Lazarescu. That's the movie. It takes us to every single one of those stops and does not ellipses or fade in and out any of them. And we just have to sit through it and watch it, and that's the heartache of it. So I want to have us look at one of those scenes, and I want you to tell the class what's being shown, what's the pace, leisurely or not, of that scene, what's included, what isn't, who are we sympathizing with, aren't we, is it a clinical portrait that is valorizing or critical, and what in particular is being criticized. It's not just doctors bad, Mr. Lazarescu good. No, what's happening more fraught in terms of the population, the people that are making up a particular sort of scene. So anyway, group one, talk to her, that scene. Group two, death of Mr. Lazarescu. You guys can take about, I'd say about 20 minutes to sort of get together, the sort of talks, the sort of things you want to share. Like I said, best thing to do is just sit and look at your scene as a group and then parlay right into thinking about what kind of things you want to share. And then we're going to reconvene and look at those scenes and people are going to share what their sort of insights are. Like I said, group one, best to sort of point our class towards that little paragraph in the article. And group two, think about what's being represented clinically in the portrait or in the critique of what's happening in the clinic at that moment.
What's the name of the title for the death of that scene?
It's scene number 9. Oh. Yep. Any questions? Okay.
So two stays here, right?
So why don't we have, yeah, you want group two to stay here?
Sure.
And group one, want to go in the student lounge? Is that good?
Sure.
Yeah.
Five.
Group one?
One.
Okay, the time is, it's on 1 hour and 1 minute.
1 hour
and 8 minutes or so. Something kind of basically the same as the sound film.
Okay,
so 101.
101.
Yep. And group two?
Mm-hmm. Ta-da.
Ta-da. And okay. Do you want to put it in here?
Yeah,
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 you can all watch it up there together.
That's
yeah, totally.
Ooh.
That was the benefit of sitting.
I know, right?
It was, so it didn't receive any critical acclaim?
Oh, it did.
Oh, it did.
Oh, okay.
It was entirely critical acclaimed.
Yeah.
It was the fact that not many people went to the movie to see
the movies,
it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little long beyond what people
every
can.
Every year comes out with some film that just cleans up. Because isn't that abortion movie also from Romania?
Which one?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just think it's like 5 days, something. It's like,
7 hours, 8 months, 5 weeks, and those days, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're picking back up.
And you know what was really funny with how slow they were walking? And they've all got it in their backs, urgency.
Oh, yeah, no, okay.
Urgency, right? Emergency.
Oh, yeah.
How much of the scene do you guys want to show?
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, sure? Okay.
It's pretty long, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's like 6 or 8 minutes or something, so I don't know if there's a specific portion you guys are focusing on, or...
We're kind of focusing on it generally.
Okay, what I might do is...
Just show the end, the very end.
The sexual part at the end?
Right, and where it transitions back into the hospital.
Yeah, yeah. In other words, skip the laboratory part at the beginning,
yeah.
Yada yada. So everybody knows the first group we're looking at here is doing talk to her, and we're going to do the scene that involves the silent film, and the film that he's seen, Bino's seen the night before, and talking to her about the film he saw and how that becomes a kind of metaphor or entree to thinking about the sexual act that can happen between him and her. So let's see here, it was at... Okay, so this is the silent film. Does the group who's doing this want to tell us just very briefly kind of what the premise is here at this moment?
Well, she's a scientist and she makes a
she discovers something and the guy drinks it, and after he drinks it, he keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So then she's working really hard to find an antidote, is having problems. So he runs off to live with his mom because he feels like he's distressing her because he's getting smaller and she's not able to help him. So he feels like he's distressing her, so his resolution is to go and leave to his mom's house. And then I think, where do you want to show it from, I guess, where she picks him up or...
Mm-hmm. Just tell me where to stop.
Well, the whole, you almost can't excerpt it. The whole thing is a dramatic arc. So, but
right here?
He's telling her about the film.
Robin, is this what you're talking about?
Oh, it's really before there.
Well, let's just take it from here.
De la madre de Alfredo. Y allí se presenta.
Thank you. So talk to me, group number one, about the use of the silent film here. Function in the plot and stylistic effect.
Don't all speak.
Take it away.
Well, maybe I'll start. I had only briefly seen bits of the film before, not this scene, and I was really struck by the dramatic arc of the silent film. The way I see it is it's a modern retelling of the Tristan legend, of the medieval tale of Tristan and Isolde, which is most popular through the great opera Wagner of 1865. The dramatic arc is identical. There's a potion. They believe that by drinking potion, they're drinking death. But they're not, which releases them to admit how they feel, what the two characters feel about each other, which is intense love. Act two is frustration and separation. Act three is the death of Tristan, and Isolde, who is a healer, is an ancient art of healing, has to find him essentially in the sea voyage, finds where he is in Cariole, and when she's reunited with him is when he's released to die. He has a wound which can't be healed. And upon seeing her, he expires. He's attended by his male attendant, Corvinal, who's the mother in this film. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, Corvinal is called by Wagner the watchdog, essentially, the watchman over the delirious Tristan. Like the mother is watching her son, protecting him from essentially any intervention. And even the musical palette, although it doesn't quote Tristan, the use of woodwinds and strings in about the same tonal texture as the opening of the famous third act of Tristan, so-called delirium act. I think the importance of the silent film to this particular movie is that it's the realization, for me at least, that Benigno's healing, essentially, his integration, at least as he perceives it, depends on her. He loses himself in her, which is what the sex act is about.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, that is what the opera ultimately is about. The opera is actually not about love, in my opinion. It's about the disintegration of a personality, Tristan's. And he can only find himself in this other world of his passion for Isolde.
Did the rest of the people in Group 1 find a similar sort of take on what in terms of what the plot is in this silent film? The sexual act is one where he literally goes inside of her, literally, not in the way we euphemistically mean when people have penetrative sex, but he enters her, so to speak. Does that seem to you to be an exaggeration or an analogy to what's happening outside of the silent film and the rest of the movie? Anybody?
One thing that I was saying about it is that it didn't seem like the main problem was, like, will this person or won't this person consent, but that it could be, like, an act that had both people engaging mm-hmm. in it mutually, just the same way, you know, like, the woman is asleep.
Yeah.
And how, you know, the men believe that, like, were the woman awake, it would be, you know, it wouldn't be, like, oh, will you consent? It would just be this lovely mutual thing, and so we're just... So that was the one thing, is that it seemed to me to be very, like, comfortable to swallow as a representation of a, of a sex act.
Yeah.
In a way where you were just so sort of engrossed in the narrative that it didn't feel, like, particularly disgusting, like, you know, staring at, like, a very close-up of a vagina.
Yeah.
For minutes at a time.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of things that are rendering comfortable through the use of this silent film. The close-up of the vagina and the way that it's almost cartoonish is part of that way in which we don't feel like we're objectifying a literal body, but instead a prop in some way that's standing in for a body. Mm-hmm. The quote that I had you guys think about to share with the class that was from this article is on page 321, and it says, Almodovar wants us to believe that the rape violates a fictitious body, the body of Aurora, the woman in the silent film, and not that of the real Alicia in Talk to Her. This message is intensified as we watch Aurora experience orgasm when Alfredo in the silent film literally crawls inside of her, which is to say, one of the ways that the rape in the fictitious film that is Talk to Her is rendered more comfortable is by couching it within the fictitious silent film that's within it as well, which is to say, that layering is an attempt to distance us from what is an uncomfortable sort of act that is sort of being represented on screen. And yet, the comfort with which we see it doesn't take away the dilemma that it is for us to watch it and not only watch it and enjoy it, which is to say the expression of pleasure on the face of Aurora in the silent film, I think, has its parallel in us enjoying talk to her in the movie theater at the same time. And that's the rub, I think, about what the film is trying to provide for us. That is its bioethical sort of like value. It's not what do we do when we have people who are in PVS or comas, but rather how do we appreciate, interact, not just talk to these individuals, but enjoy these individuals or not. And is that an ethically fraught kind of relationship to some degree? Any other thoughts about why the silent film is sort of used as a vehicle in this portion of the film? What else does it help to make render comfortable?
Well, I know you referred to kind of the sexual engagement of the little man and Aurora as a rape, but it didn't seem particularly as violating as it does in the context of Lucian, you know, because it's established that they have a romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
She shrinks him, is trying feverishly for 10 years to make him better. She rescues him from his mother, which might have parallels between Benigno and his mother and rescuing that Alicia. If we're talking about her as taking care of, you know, Benigno's pathology. And then they go to a hotel room, which is classically a place where lovers go to have sex in private. And so
they have pillow talk.
Right. And so she's like, you know, having an orgasm. She
has an expression
probably,
face.
You know, like awake and you know not uncomfortable with what's going on. It's there's more of a permissibility there.
Totally.
And so it when we look at Benigno's rape of Alicia, which is I think more typically or like a rape or a violation because you can't be consenting despite the fact that both pairs have barriers to intimacy. It somehow makes it a little bit more open to the possibility of being kind of a loving engagement.
The silent film is very savvy in showing that consent isn't black and white. You know what I mean? That there's a kind of gray way with which it's gray or shady to say, did she consent or isn't she? Is she enjoying it or isn't she? Even at the level where a rape is supposed to be painful, and that's supposed to be one of the signs that makes the difference between whether it was a pleasurable sex act or not, the pain someone didn't want, his being shrunk and making it so easy for him to literally not just go inside her in the figurative sense, but himself entirely, takes away another one of those red flags we're supposed to have about does this scene seem to be, you know, impinging upon her sort of pleasure, her consent to be a part of it. And so the silent film is kind of an interesting way of complicating and enhancing the relationship that's already happening between Benigno and Alicia. Yeah.
It also parallels Alicia's silence.
Yeah, exactly. And the silent film becomes then, as I was telling that group, that you know, all films that are about comatose persons or persons who are incapacitated have the potential to feel like, well, dialogue is going to be hard to do in this movie, you know, which is to say they're going to be silent. That's why a movie called Talk to Her, that has as its core relationships with people who are in coma, sounds oxymoronic or something, you know? And thus, to use a silent film as the vehicle is to say that sometimes things are communicated through silence, that sometimes in the absence of being able to have dialogue, how are things said in major and significant ways? And the silent film is providing for us almost in a kind of mini blueprint for the work that we're doing throughout the entire movie, I think, also.
Did you think that was a rape in the silent film?
Well, I mean, it is in the sense that if you took any other construct of a woman who goes to sleep and the man penetrates her while she's asleep without getting her permission, we could, in some circumstances, consider that.
You don't think
that
she knew what was happening then?
Well, we don't know, you know? I mean, and the point of the fact of the matter is that in that scene, it doesn't appear to be, but for any number of reasons with which to show that consent or rape itself isn't as black and white as we might think in that particular moment. Thus, that, and I was telling this to the group in the other room when they were working on this, that probably the most deft thing that Almodovar does in this film is he vilifies almost no one by the end of the film, which is to say there are any number of plot points in this film in any other director's hands or any other sort of movie, it would be very easy to identify that is the villain, that is the person I do not like, what have you. But in this film, the dance that's sort of being done very delicately is between showing things that could render us unsympathetic towards a person and yet never having us completely sort of vilify that individual. And thus, that's what's fraught ethically for us in watching the movie. Jolie?
So, does everybody know that he rapes? Now I'm not talking about the black and white film, now I'm talking about the actual film. The indication of the rape is the blood afterwards.
Anybody?
That
little looks like a lava lamp.
And she has lava lamps.
She had what? Yeah.
She has lava lamps next to her.
Yeah.
What does she have beside her?
Lava lamps.
There's a lava lamp.
Do you know what a lava lamp is?
No.
A lava lamp is. You see it in like 70s show and shit like that, you know?
It has like blobs inside of it.
It's sometimes shaped kind of like this, you know?
It's like heated up web. Yeah. You watch it when you're hot. It's awesome.
It's like bubbles, you know?
Right.
You see?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're bubble lips. Yeah, that's what that is. So she has one or two in her room,
yeah,
I think, in the hospital.
How do you know he rapes her?
She's not raped in this scene, right?
The movie.
Yeah. Is there an actual rape scene?
No.
So how does anybody know what happened?
Because they talk about
her period.
Because she stops getting her period, she gets pregnant.
So I thought maybe it could be somebody else. No, I mean, like, so you just, does everybody who's watching that actually, like, you knew at that point that there had been a sexual encounter?
I can't say if I remember at that point if that's what I came up with, because I've seen it several times and several years ago. Anybody else?
I think I kind of.
And it was a very suspicious hour. Like his lob. Hand is like,
yeah.
And everything. Like, but he's going to do something.
And the lava
was
kind
you're
of
wondering
like
enough, and then it's confirmed a little bit later.
And also,
yeah,
like,
that kind of directions.
Splitting. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
It's.
Because I thought it could have been somebody else. Because he, you know, you could take the position, right? He was, you know, listen, his touching her leg was no more, or what he was doing then was no more intimate than around the breast, to me. How I felt
the
it was.
Lamp, you well, see.
Right.
What about the lava?
It looked like it was internal. It was making, like, the internal external.
So is your, just,
so like a merging.
Just to sort of table this, because we can't linger on this.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
Is your problem that in this moment you're not sure if it, that's what it means, or now in hindsight, having seen the entire film, it doesn't make sense? I don't care about the first one. The second one's the one that might worry me, the fact that the significance of the silent film and the way that it provides a kind of blueprint for the way in which we can think about the sexual act that could be happening here.
No, I just meant that I didn't 100% when I watched it the first time think that it was Benigno who had raped her, that I thought it could have been somebody else
who
walked in. And, well, look, he took some care of it. I mean, that's the whole ambivalence of this, right?
Yeah,
the whole ambiguity of it. Is it sexual or is it caretaking or is it both?
Right, we're not trying to render a verdict here is what I'm trying to say, but rather to groove in the place that is the possibility of how uncomfortable it could be that there's this sexual actor, and that we have come along on that ride through lava lamps and silent films and close-ups of this woman's body, and honoring the reverence with which he has to her, even as we're troubled by it sort of at the same time as sort of what's happening. And the silent film is sort of one other layer, I think, that sort of removes us from it, but in removing it from us, it's just getting us even deeper, I think, within that dilemma of sympathizing with the characters here. Any last thoughts on this moment? I'm going to close here, and I'm going to save the scene from Death of Mr. Last Rescue for next time, because actually it's going to segue nicely into The Savages. But what I want to say about Death of Mr. Last Rescue, and those of you who, if you're going to be here next week, can certainly tell us what this scene is about, is that that movie, as I mentioned, is about this idea that we're seeing moment after moment that's sort of dealing with the care for Mr. Lazarescu that's yet to come. It's almost a film that's about forestalling. You know, it's him needing to go to a clinic and needing to go to an emergency room and again and again and again and it not quite happening. The metaphor that I used in the second group was like it's like trying to start the lawnmower and it's a yank and it's a yank and it's a yank and it's a yank. Which is to say that the film, at the level of trying to think how films that have bioethical value are not just about the content that's in their story but what it is to be an experience of watching them, it appears that the Death of Mr. Lazarescu's bioethical contribution is that failure to provide care is what the story is about, and the failure to sort of service patients. But we are not just failing Mr. Lazarescu clinically in the film by not getting him the care he needs that ultimately leads to him die. We are failing him ethically as cinema goers because we are not engaging with his story, and we can't even tell halfway or by the end of the film if we even like the guy. We never got to know him. Because the film was fits and starts trying to begin. And so the failure to provide care isn't just literally the kind of hands-on treatment he was supposed to get in the film. It's the care we're supposed to give as invested sort of parties in his story. And so the scene that we're going to look at, or one of the scenes that we'll look at next week with the group, is just sort of thinking, like, let's look at one of these moments that shows the stalling that's sort of happening here narratively and how that represents in its own right, in a narrative, cinematic sort of way, an ethical quandary that the film itself is about in the clinic as well. So next week we're going to talk about The Savages, and we're talking about Death of Mr. Lazarescu. If you want to watch The Savages, we're going to be screening it after class in like 15 minutes or so. And thanks, everybody. Have a great week.